have your attention, please. My name is Josef Shima. I am chairman of Department of Economic Policy at the Prague School of Economics. I'm also editorial director at the Liberální Institute of Prague. And most importantly for this event, I am president of Prague Conference on Political Economy. I'm thrilled to have an opportunity to welcome you here in the heart of Europe and hope the 3 days of the conference will be a great intellectual adventure for all of us. PCPE, Prague Conference on Political Economy, has already become a traditional annual meeting of scholars in social sciences from all over the world. This year, we have participants from 17 countries, both from North and South America, Central, Western, and Eastern Europe, some of them distinguished full professors, some of them young assistant professors, some of them PhD students, but all of them, by being here, are helping us to pursue the goal of the conference. This conference is an attempt to resurrect the tradition of critical thinking, crossing boundaries of traditional disciplines, the tradition of broadly defined economics with its connection to law, political science, history, and philosophy, the tradition of the Austrian economics and liberty-oriented thinking that thrived in Central Europe at the beginning of the 20th century, but sadly disappeared thereafter. For this reason, we set up two annual prizes called after two great scholars, František Čuhel and Friedrich von Wieser, whose lives are closely connected with the city of Prague. And this afternoon, the first day of the conference, will be devoted to the legacy of those two great men. However, before we start with our annual lectures, and later on with several prize announcements, and even later with our wonderful book launch, I have to mention some people and some institutions which made this event possible. Let me first introduce you, though I'm not sure whether he is here in the room, Josef Zdechovan, my colleague and student, who is the director of PCPE. Is Josef here? Not really, he is busy with the conference, that's good. And his team, which you had a chance to meet already, you will be able to recognize the organizers by the blue badges. So please, anytime you have any problem with anything, approach the closest man or woman wearing the blue badge, and he will help you. Next to the organizers, I have to mention our sponsors of the conference, which is, first of all, European Social Fund, that is supporting a project at the Faculty of Economics and Public Administration of the Economic University of Prague. The project is to develop new master programs, one devoted to environmental economics and the other one to the study of economics, law, and institutions. There are several sections tomorrow devoted to these two core subjects of the newly emerging master program at our faculty. Also, I have to mention Friedrich Naumann Stiftung, or Friedrich Naumann Foundation, who sponsors Johann Norberg's visit and also kindly supported the translation of his book In Defense of Global Capitalism into Czech. We'll have a chance to meet Mr. Johann Norberg after the break today in the late afternoon. My thanks also go to the Liberalny Institute for co-organization of the whole conference and for providing books for the winners of Henry Hazlitt Annual Prize for the Best Essay. We'll have this announcement later in the day too. And of course I have to, and I'm very happy to thank to Dr. Jiří Švorc, the Dean of the Faculty of Economics and Public Administration, for his continual support of this project, and Professor Machková, the university new vice president, for her encouragement and plans for future cooperation. At this moment, I would like to invite to the podium Dr. Jiří Švorc, the Dean of the Faculty of Economics and Public Administration, to open up the conference. Dr. Švorc, please, the floor is yours.
Ladies and gentlemen, my role is more or less ceremonial here. So I'm very glad that such a huge number of participants we have on the second Prague conference on political economy. The number of participants is higher than was last year. The Faculty of Economics at Prague University of Economics is very happy that can co-organize this conference. This conference is an excellent tool for presentation of our research. The faculty's research is based on research on six departments of this faculty, and according to the rank published in the Czech Republic, our faculty is the most successful faculty according to the number of articles published in the professional journals with positive impact within Prague University of Economics. So that is very important, and also with this conference we would like to support research. This year conference we also connected with announcement of the best research works presented by our students. So during the breaks we will have opportunity just to give them awards for their successful research. So I think that the faculty is quite successful within last 3 years. So during my dean's period, we doubled the number of applicants that would like to be enrolled in my faculty. So among our successes is also very active participation of Czech President Václav Klaus. It was thanks to Dr. Tříska here. Václav Klaus is one of our faculty members, and he leads a seminar of economics of transition, quite successful and highly demanded among our students. So I am quite sure that the program of the conference is very inspiring. I am sure that we have excellent speakers, and we will have also very provocative papers as well as provocative discussions. So I wish you excellent conference and good stay in Prague, and hope to see you during the conference. Thank you.
Now, ladies and gentlemen, we can move to the first part of the program, which is the announcement of Franz Čuhel, Memorial Prize. Franz Čuhel was a Czech economist who had been a member of Eugen von Böhm-Bawerk's seminar in the years before the World War I. His book, written in German, Zur Lehre von der Bedürfnissen, is a famous and pioneering attempt at establishing the concept of ordinal rather than cardinal utility. This achievement was acknowledged by the great Ludwig von Mises and in his wonderful books, and then brought through the work of Lionel Robbins into English-speaking economic world. It is my great pleasure to have here today Professor Jesus Huerta de Soto as a recipient of Franz Čuhel Prize. Professor de Soto from the Rey Juan Carlos University is not only a leading Spanish, but a leading European economist who is famous for his work on socialism, economic calculation, and indeed, money and banking. This is his book, very thick book, almost 1,000 pages, that was released a few months ago in English. You can see the title, Money, Bank Credit, and Economic Cycles. Professor de Soto, please approach me to receive the PCPE 2006 Čuhel Memorial Prize for Excellence in Economic Education.
Thank you very much.
This is your prize.
Very nice indeed. Thank you very much.
And we look forward to your annual lecture, which, by the way, is available in print outside of the lecture hall for everybody who wants to take one. The floor is yours.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much again for this great prize and also for your kind introduction. It is for me a great honor and privilege to be here today, and I would like to thank the Prague University of Economics and also to Professor Josef Sima for inviting me to Prague to speak about the Spanish scholastics and the theory of dynamic efficiency in this marvelous city. So I will divide my presentation in three different parts. In the first one, I will speak about the Spanish roots of Austrian economics. In the second, I will introduce, following the Austrian tradition, a dynamic concept of economic efficiency. And third, I will try to demonstrate the intimate relationship that exists between ethics and efficiency in the capitalist system. So, let me begin by making a few points on what I think is the true origin of the Austrian School of Economics, and that which should be traced back to the works of the Spanish scholastics of what is known as the Siglo de Oro Español. Siglo de Oro Español, in English, is the Spanish Golden Age, which ran from the mid-16th century through the 17th century. The great Austrian scholar Murray Rothbard was the first one to develop the thesis that the Austrian school is of Spanish origin in 1974, in this famous South Royalton Conference. And also, the Nobel Prize winner Friedrich von Hayek shared Rothbard's view, particularly after Hayek met Bruno Leoni, the Italian scholar and author of the book Freedom and the Law. These two scholars, Hayek and Leoni, met in the 50s, in the 1950s, and Leoni convinced Hayek that the intellectual origins of classical economic liberalism lay in Mediterranean Europe, and certainly not in Scotland. I have a letter here from Hayek dated January 7, 1979. Hayek sent us this letter when we were preparing the first regional Bompering Society regional meeting in Salamanca, Spain, in which Hayek wrote us that Rothbard, quote, "This demonstrates that the basic principles of the theory of the competitive market were worked out by the Spanish scholastics of the 16th century, and that economic liberalism was not designed by the Calvinists, but by the Spanish Jesuits." End of quote. And Hayek concludes his letter telling us that, "I can assure you, from my personal knowledge of the sources, that Rothbard's case is extremely strong." Now, who were these Spanish intellectual ancestors of the modern free market movement? Most of them were scholastics teaching morals and theology at the university city of Salamanca, which is a wonderful medieval city located 150 miles to the northwest of Madrid, close to the border of my country with Portugal. These scholastics were mainly either Dominicans or Jesuits, and as we are about to see now, they were able to articulate the subjectivist, dynamic, and libertarian tradition, which 250 years later was to be stressed by Karl Menger and his followers of the Austrian School of Economics. Let us recall some of their main contributions. Perhaps the first author to be mentioned should be Diego de Covarrubias y Leiva. What's his name? Covarrubias was born in 1512, the son of a famous architect, and he became bishop of the city of Segovia and also minister of King Philip II. If you should visit Spain, I recommend you to tour the museum of the great Spanish painter El Greco in the city of Toledo. There you will see a stunning portrait of Covarrubias, who in 1554 set forth better than anyone before him the subjectivist theory of value, which is the foundation of all free market principles. Specifically, Covarrubias concludes that, quote, "The value of an article does not depend on its essential nature, but on the subjective estimation of men, even if that estimation is foolish." End of quote. And he adds that in the Indies, wheat is dearer than in Spain because men esteem it more highly, though the nature of the wheat is the same in both places. Another important author is Luis Sarabia de la Calle. Sarabia de la Calle was the first Spanish scholastic to demonstrate that prices determine costs, not vice versa. Sarabia de la Calle also has the special merit of having written his main work in Spanish, not in Latin. Its title is Instrucción de Mercaderes. In English, would be Instruction to Merchants or to Entrepreneurs. And in this book we read that, quote, "Those who measure the just price by the labor, costs, and risk incurred by the person who deals in the merchandise are greatly in error, because the just price is found not by counting the cost, but by the subjective common estimation of men." Sarabia de la Calle is also a great critic of fractional reserve banking. He maintains that receiving interest from a bank is incompatible with the nature of a demand deposit, and that in any case, a fee should be paid to the banker for the custody and safekeeping of the money entrusted to him. And a similar conclusion is reached by another famous Spanish scholastic, Martín Azpilcueta. Azpilcueta was also known as Dr. Navarro, because he was born in Navarra, the northeastern autonomous region of Spain, famous for the encierros, the famous festival held in the region's capital city of Pamplona, where every July people run in front of the bulls at great risk of their lives. Azpilcueta was born the year following the discovery of America in 1493, lived to be 94 years old, and is especially famous for explaining the quantity theory of money for the first time in 1556. Azpilcueta observed the effects on Spanish prices of the massive inflow of precious metals coming from America and declared, quote, "Experience shows that in France, where there is less money than in Spain, bread, wine, clothes, and labor cost much less. And even when there was less money in Spain, saleable items and the labor of men were given for much less than after the Indies were discovered and covered Spain with gold and silver. The reason is that money is worth more when and where it is scarce than when and where it is abundant." End of quote. The Spanish scholastics also gained a clear insight into the true nature of market prices and the impossibility of attaining an economic equilibrium. So the Jesuit Cardinal Juan de Lugo, wondering what the equilibrium price was, as early as 1643, reached the conclusion that the equilibrium depends on such a large number of specific circumstances that only God can know it. In Latin, he stated, "Pretium justum mathematicum, licet soli Deo notum." And another Jesuit, Juan de Salas, with regard to the possibility that an authority, the government, could come to know the specific information of the market needed to regulate it, asserted that it is so complex that, in Latin, quas exacte comprendere et ponderare Dei est non hominum, in English, that only God, not men, can understand that market information exactly. Furthermore, the Spanish scholastics were the first to introduce the dynamic concept of competition. In Latin, they call competition with the Latin name concurrentium, which is best understood as a process of rivalry among entrepreneurs. For instance, Jerónimo Castilla de Bobadilla in 1547 wrote that, quote, "Prices will go down by an abundance of sellers and by rivalry," in Latin emulación, rivalry, "and competition," in Latin concurrentia, "among the sellers." So, like Ludwig von Mises, Friedrich von Hayek, and most members of the Austrian school, who are naturally prone to be classical liberals, the subjectivist Spanish scholastics also tended to defend strong libertarian positions in political matters. For instance, the founder of international law, the Dominican Francisco de Vitoria, began the Spanish scholastic tradition of denouncing the conquest, and particularly the enslavement of the Indians by the Spanish in the New World, thus reviving the idea that natural law is morally superior to the mere might of the state. And this natural law tradition was further developed by the great libertarian Jesuit Juan de Mariana, who in his book on the alteration of money, in Latin, De Monetae Mutatione, published in 1609, condemns as robbery any government debasement of coins. Mariana also maintained in his well-known theory on tyrannies that any individual citizen can justly assassinate a governor who imposes taxes without the people's consent, seizes the property of individuals and squanders it, or simply prevents a meeting of a democratic parliament. The only doctrine on which I disagree with Mariana is in his condemnation of the typical Spanish fiesta of bullfighting. But being as I am the grandson of a famous Spanish bullfighter, I concede that I am probably not too impartial on this matter. Now, let me remind you that in the 16th century, the Emperor Charles V, the Kaiser, who was the king of Spain, sent his brother Ferdinand I to be king, or better, Archduke, of Austria. And etymologically, Austria means eastern part of the empire, which in those days comprised almost all of continental Europe, with the sole exception of France, which remained an island surrounded by Spanish forces. Now you will understand the origin of the intellectual influence the Spanish scholastics exerted on the Austrian school. This was not a pure coincidence or a mere whim of history, but originated from the intimate historical, political, and cultural relations which arose beginning in the 1500s between Spain and Austria, and which would continue for several centuries. Italy certainly also played an important role in this connection, acting as a cultural, economic, and financial bridge over which the relations between the two farthest points of the empire, Spain and Austria, flowed. So as you see, there are very strong arguments to support the thesis that at least at its roots, the Austrian school is a truly Spanish school. Indeed, I think the greatest merit of the founder of the Austrian school, Karl Menger, was to rediscover and take up this continental Catholic tradition of Spanish scholastic thought, which was almost forgotten due to the negative influence of Adam Smith and his followers of the British classical school. To quote Professor Leland Jäger in his review of Rothbard's last book on the history of economic thought, quote, Adam Smith dropped earlier contributions about subjective value, entrepreneurship, an emphasis on real-world markets and pricing, and replaced it all with a labor theory of value and a dominant focus on the long-run natural price equilibrium, a world where entrepreneurship was assumed out of existence. Adam Smith also mixed up Calvinism with economics, as in supporting usury prohibition and distinguishing between productive and unproductive occupations. Adam Smith lapsed from the laissez-faire, from the, I would say, radical laissez-faire of several 18th century French, Italian, and Spanish economists, introducing many waffles and qualifications. And Smith's work was unsystematic and plagued by contradictions. End of quote. Fortunately, and despite the overwhelming intellectual imperialism of the British classical school, the continental, subjectivist, free market tradition was never totally forgotten. Several economists, like Cantillon, Turgot, and Say, kept the torch of subjectivism and entrepreneurial analysis burning. Even in Spain, during the years of decline in the 18th and 19th centuries, the old scholastic tradition survived in spite of the typical inferiority complex toward the British intellectual world at that time. We find proof of this in the fact that another Spanish Catholic writer solved the paradox of value and clearly set forth the theory of marginal utility 27 years earlier than Karl Menger did. His name was Jaime Balmes. Balmes was born in Catalonia in 1810 and passed away in 1848. During his short life, he became the most important Spanish Thomistic philosopher of all Spain. And a few years before his death, on September 7, 1844, he published an article entitled True Idea of Value, or Thoughts on the Origin, Nature, and Variety of Prices. In this article, Balmes solves the paradox of value and clearly sets forth the idea of marginal utility. Balmes asks himself, quote, why is a precious stone worth more than a piece of bread? And he answers, it is not difficult to explain, since the value of a thing is determined by its utility. if the number of means of satisfying a need increases, the need for any one of them in particular decreases. As it is possible to choose among many, none of them is indispensable. For this reason, a necessary relationship exists between an increase or decrease in value and the shortage or abundance of a thing. End of quote. In this way, Balmes was able to close the circle of the continental Catholic tradition of subjectivism, which could then be completed a few years later by Karl Menger and enhanced by his followers of the Austrian School of Economics. We can conclude then that to a large extent we owe to these great thinkers of the Spanish Golden Age the current revival of free market liberalism and of the Austrian School of Economics all over the world. And now, let us proceed with the second part of my presentation. I am going to criticize the mainstream static concept of economic efficiency, which I propose to replace with a typically Austrian concept of dynamic efficiency. The term efficiency derives etymologically from the Latin verb ex facio, which means to obtain something from. The application to economics of this concept of efficiency as the ability to obtain something from predates, of course, the Roman world and can even be traced back to ancient Greece, where the term oikonomia was first used to refer to the efficient management of the family home. Now let us remember that Xenophon, in his work on economics, written 380 years before Christ, explains that there are two different ways to increase the family estate, and each is equivalent to a different concept of efficiency, of economic efficiency. The first idea corresponds to the static concept of efficiency and consists of the sound management of the available or given economic resources to prevent them from being wasted. According to Xenophon, the best way to achieve this static efficiency is by keeping the home in good order, is what he writes in his book. However, along with the concept of static efficiency, Xenophon introduces a different concept, that of dynamic efficiency, which consists of the attempt to increase one's estate through entrepreneurial creativity, that is, by trade and speculation, more than by the effort to avoid wasting the resources already available. This tradition of clearly distinguishing between the two different concepts of economic efficiency, the static and the dynamic, survived even until the Middle Ages. For example, Saint Bernardine of Siena wrote that the profit of merchants was justified not only by the sound management of their already given resources, but also and mainly by the assumption of the risks and dangers, in Latin pericula, perils, which arise from any entrepreneurial speculation. And here is implicit, of course, the concept of dynamic efficiency. Unfortunately, the development of mechanical physics, which began with the modern age, had a very negative influence on the evolution of economic thought, especially after the 19th century, when the idea of dynamic efficiency was almost entirely forgotten in economics. Both the Austrian Hans Meyer, before the Second World War, and Philip Mirowski nowadays have stressed that mainstream neoclassical economics developed as a pure copy of 19th century mechanical physics, using the same formal method, but replacing the concept of energy with that of utility, and applying the same principles of conservation, maximization of the result, and minimization of waste. The author, perhaps most representative of this very negative trend, was Leon Balras, who, for instance, in his paper Economics and Mechanics, published in 1909, claimed that the mathematical formulas of his book, Elements of Pure Economics, are identical to those of mathematical physics. In short, the influence of mechanical physics eradicated the creative, speculative, and dynamic dimension which was implicit in the idea of economic efficiency from its very beginning. And all that remained was the reductionist static aspect, which consists solely of minimizing the waste of already known or given economic resources. This change occurred despite the fact that neither the resources nor technology are given in real life, but actually do vary continually as a result of entrepreneurial creativity. This reductionist concept of static efficiency had an immense theoretical and practical influence in the 20th century. For instance, the Fabian socialists Sidney and Beatrice Webb provide a wonderful example of that. This married couple were shocked by the waste they believed was produced in the capitalist system, and they precisely founded the London School of Economics in an effort to champion the socialist reform of capitalism. The object of such socialist reform would be to eliminate waste and make the economic system efficient. The Webbs later made no secret of their warm admiration for the efficiency they believed they observed in Soviet Russia, to the point that Beatrice even declared, quote, "I fell in love with Soviet communism," end of quote. And another noted author to be entirely influenced by the static concept of economic efficiency was John Maynard Keynes himself, who in his introduction to the 1936 German edition of his General Theory expressly states that his typically Keynesian economic policy proposals, quote, "are more easily adapted to the conditions of a totalitarian state," end of quote. And Keynes also highly praised the book Soviet Communism, which Sidney and Beatrice Webb had published 3 years earlier. Furthermore, in the 1920s and 1930s, the static concept of economic efficiency became the focal point for a whole new discipline which came to be known as welfare economics, and which grew from alternative approaches, of which the Pareto approach is probably the most well known. From a Paretean perspective, an economic system is in a state of efficiency if no one can be made better off without making someone else worse off. Our main criticism of welfare economics is that it reduces the problem of economic efficiency to a simple mathematical problem of maximization, in which all the economic data are assumed to be given and constant. However, both assumptions are entirely wrong. The data are continually changing as a result of entrepreneurial creativity. And precisely for that reason, we need to introduce an alternative concept, that of dynamic efficiency, understood as the capacity to foster both entrepreneurial creativity as well as coordination. In other words, dynamic efficiency consists of the entrepreneurial capacity to discover profit opportunities, as well as the capacity to coordinate and overcome any social maladjustments. In terms of neoclassical economics, the goal of dynamic efficiency should not be to move the system toward the production possibility frontier, but rather to enhance entrepreneurial creativity and thus to continually shift the production possibility curve toward the right. The word entrepreneurship derives etymologically from the Latin term imprendo. Imprendo in Latin means to discover, to see, to realize something. In this sense, we may define entrepreneurship as the typically human ability to recognize opportunities for subjective profit which appear in the environment and to act accordingly to take advantage of them. Entrepreneurship, therefore, involves a special alertness
which the Webster Dictionary defines as, quote, the ability to be watchful, vigilant. Also, fully applicable to the idea of entrepreneurship is the verb to speculate, which also comes from the Latin word specula. Specula refers in Latin to the towers from which lookouts could see into the distance to try to detect anything that approached. Every entrepreneurial action not only creates and transmits new information, but also coordinates the previously discoordinated behavior of economic agents. Whenever someone discovers or creates a profit opportunity and buys a certain resource cheap and sells it dear, he harmonizes the previously discoordinated behavior of the owners of the resource, who very probably were squandering and wasting it, with the behavior of those in need of that resource. Therefore, creativity and coordination are two sides of the same, I would say, entrepreneurial coin. Now, from a dynamic standpoint, an individual, a company, an institution, or even an entire economic system or society will be more efficient the more it promotes entrepreneurial creativity and coordination. And from this dynamic perspective, the truly important goal is not so much to prevent the waste of certain means considered known and given, as it is to continually discover and create new ends and means. For a more extensive treatment of this entire matter, I recommend you the principal works of Mrs. Hayek, Israel Kirchner, and Murray Rothbard on the idea of the market as a dynamic process driven by entrepreneurship, and on the notion of competition as a process of discovery and creativity. In my opinion, these Austrian authors provide us with the most exact concept of dynamic efficiency, which contrasts with the more imperfect concept of dynamic efficiency developed, for instance, by both Joseph Alois Schumpeter and Douglas North. North and Schumpeter offer totally opposite perspectives. While Schumpeter exclusively considers the aspect of entrepreneurial creativity and its destructive power, which he calls the process of creative destruction, Douglas North concentrates on the other aspect, which he calls adaptive efficiency, or the coordinating capacity of entrepreneurship. Now we see that the true Austrian concept of dynamic efficiency, that developed by Mrs. Hayek and Kirchner, combines both the creative and coordinating dimensions, which Schumpeter and North studied only in a separate, partial, and reductionist manner. And now, and third and finally, let us concentrate on my last line of research, on the intimate relationship that exists between ethics and the concept of dynamic efficiency, which I have just presented. Mainstream neoclassical economic theory rests on the idea that information is objective and given, either in certain or probabilistic terms, and that the issues of utility maximization have absolutely no connection with moral considerations. Furthermore, the dominant static viewpoint led to the conclusion that resources are in a sense given and known, and therefore the economic problem of their distribution was deemed separate and different from the issue of their production. Granted, if resources are given, it is vitally important to inquire into the best way to allocate among different people both the available means of production and the consumer goods that result from them. But this whole approach collapses like a stack of cards if we adhere to the dynamic concept of market processes, the theory of entrepreneurship, and the notion of dynamic efficiency I just have explained. From this perspective, every human being has a unique creative capacity that continually enables him to perceive and discover new profit opportunities. And entrepreneurship consists of the typically human ability to create and discover new ends and means, and is the most important characteristic of human nature. If ends, means, and resources are not given, but are continually created from nothing as a result of the entrepreneurial action of human beings, clearly the fundamental ethical problem is no longer how to justly distribute what already exists, but instead how to promote entrepreneurial creativity and coordination. Consequently, in the field of social ethics, we arrive at the fundamental conclusion that the idea of human beings as creative and coordinating actors implies the axiomatic acceptance of the principle that every human being has a natural right to appropriate all results of his entrepreneurial creativity. That is, the private appropriation of the fruits of entrepreneurial creation and discovery is a tenet of natural law. And it is a tenet of natural law because if an acting person were not able to claim what he creates or discovers, his capacity to detect profit opportunities would become entirely blocked, and his incentive to act would disappear. Moreover, this principle is universal in the sense that it can be applied to all people at all possible times and in all conceivable places. To coerce free human action to any degree by impairing people's right to own what they entrepreneurially create is not only dynamically inefficient, since it obstructs their creativity and coordinating capacity, but also fundamentally immoral, since such coercion prevents human beings from developing that which is by nature their most essential item, the most essential characteristic. The innate ability to create and conceive new ends and means, and to act to attempt to achieve their own goals and objectives. Precisely for these reasons, not only socialism and interventionism, but also any form of estatism are not only dynamically inefficient, but also ethically unjust, ethically immoral. It must be taken into account that the force of entrepreneurial creativity also manifests itself in the desire to help poor people and in the systematic search for situations in which others are in need in order to try to help them. In fact, coercive state intervention through the typical mechanisms of the so-called welfare state neutralizes and to a great extent blocks the entrepreneurial effort to help one's neighbors, both close and distant, who are experiencing difficulties. And this is an idea that, for instance, Pope John Paul II very well stressed in section 49 of his 1991 encyclical Centesimus Annus. Furthermore, according to our analysis, nothing is more dynamically efficient than justice understood in its proper sense. If we think of the market as a dynamic process, then dynamic efficiency, understood as coordination and creativity, results from the behavior of human beings who follow certain moral laws, mainly regarding the respect for life, private property, and the fulfillment of contracts. Only the exercise of human action subject to these ethical principles gives rise to a dynamically efficient social process. And it is now easy to see why, from a dynamic standpoint, efficiency is not compatible with different models of equity or justice, as the second fundamental theorem of welfare economics erroneously states. But instead, efficiency arises only from one idea of justice, that based on the respect for private property, entrepreneurship, and, as we will see in a moment, also the principles of personal morality. Therefore, the contradiction between efficiency and justice is plainly false. What is just cannot be inefficient, and what is efficient cannot be unjust. A dynamic analysis reveals that justice and efficiency are but two sides of the same coin, which also confirms the consistent, integrated order that exists in the spontaneous social universe of human interactions. Now, let us conclude with some ideas on the relationship between dynamic efficiency and the principles of personal morality, especially in the field of family and sexual relations. Up to this point, we have looked at social ethics and discussed the key principles which provide the framework that makes dynamic efficiency possible. Outside of that realm lie the most intimate principles of personal morality. The influence of principles of personal morality on dynamic efficiency has rarely been studied, and in any case they are considered to be separate and different from social ethics. However, I believe this separation to be completely unjustified. In fact, there are moral principles which are of great importance to the dynamic efficiency of any society, which are subject to the following apparent paradox. The failure to uphold them on a personal level entails a huge cost in terms of dynamic efficiency. But at the same time, the attempt to impose these moral principles using the force of the state or of any private agency generates even more severe inefficiencies from the dynamic point of view. Hence, certain social institutions are needed to transmit and encourage the observance of these personal moral principles, which by their very nature cannot be imposed by violence or coercion, but are nevertheless of great importance to the dynamic efficiency of every society. It is mainly through religion and the family that human beings, generation after generation, are able to internalize these principles and thus learn to keep them and transmit them to their children. The principles which relate to sexual morality, the creation and preservation of the family institution, the faithfulness between spouses, and the care of children, the control of our atavistic instincts, and specifically the overcoming and restraint of envy, are all of crucial importance to every successful social process of creativity and coordination. For an illustration of the importance of analyzing personal moral principles in terms of the theory of dynamic efficiency, let us consider, for example, the behavior of spouses should aspire to with consistent effort in order to keep their marriages going and preserve the institution of the family, not only for their own benefit, but especially for that of their children. We can ask ourselves, for example, what happens to dynamic efficiency if husbands abandon their wives and families to live with new, more attractive, younger women? From the start, wives will then be aware of the high risk that precisely when they are getting older and the children are nearly grown, their husbands may divorce them. If such immoral behavior becomes widespread, not only will a larger number of marriages and families be broken up, but even more significantly, the rate at which new marriages and families are started will decline, and women will tend to prolong their single life to ensure their professional careers and independent means of support, all of which will lead to a dramatic drop in the birth rate. In the absence of migratory trends to ease the decrease in the birth rate and the consequent aging of the population, the social process of entrepreneurial creativity and coordination, which promotes dynamic efficiency, will be impaired. As Hayek taught us, both the progress of civilization and economic and social development require a constantly expanding population capable of sustaining, among a continually increasing number of people, a steady growth in the volume of social knowledge and information which entrepreneurial creativity generates. Dynamic efficiency depends on people's creativity and capacity for coordination, and other things being equal, it will tend to increase as the number of human beings increases, which can only happen within a certain framework of moral principles to govern family relationships. However, as I have already stated, this is a kind of a paradox. The entire framework of personal moral principles cannot be imposed by force or violent coercion. The imposition of moral principles by the force or coercion would only give rise to a closed, inquisitorial society that would deprive human beings of the individual freedoms which comprise the foundation of entrepreneurship and dynamic efficiency. This fact precisely reveals the importance of alternative, non-coercive methods of social guidance which expose people to the most intimate and personal moral principles and encourage their internalization and observance. Religious feelings and principles, which are acquired at an early age within the family, play an indispensable role in this regard, together with the social pressure exerted by other members of the family and the local community. Religious precepts provide direction under which to act, help people control their most atavistic impulses, and this is also very important, serve as a guide in the selection of those human beings of the opposite sex with whom we decide to build a family for the rest of our lives. And we can conclude that other things being equal, the firmer and more enduring personal moral principles are, the greater the dynamic efficiency of a society will tend to be. Thank you very much for your patience and attention.
Thank you, Professor De Soto, for your wonderful lecture. I just want to remind you that all of you, that Professor De Soto's book on banks, money, and the business cycle is available outside of the auditorium, and that's for sale. Let us move now to the second highlight of the conference, to the annual Friedrich von Wieser lecture. Friedrich von Wieser belongs to the towering figure of the second generation of the Austrian school, who produced such scholars as a Nobel Prize laureate Friedrich August von Hayek. Wieser taught here in Prague for more than a decade, living only in 1903 to take over Karl Menger's chair in Vienna. He will always be remembered by economists as the author of The Concept of Opportunity Cost. I am delighted to introduce to you PCPE Friedrich von Wieser Memorial Prize recipient Professor Robert Hicks. Professor Hicks taught at the University of Washington and Seattle University. He's currently a senior fellow in political economy at the Independent Institute and an editor of a journal called the Independent Review. His articles appeared in such journals such as American Economic Review, Journal of Economic History, Journal of Political Economy, or Review of Austrian Economics. He wrote numerous books, such as Crisis and Leviathan, Against Leviathan. He edited numerous books, including recently The Challenge of Liberty or Rethinking Green. All of them are for sale outside the auditorium. Over the last 2 weeks, he published a book in Czech, I'll show you. Political Economy of Fear. He became a Czech media star, being interviewed by numerous journals, newspapers, and he even made it into the public TV to be interviewed for almost 15 minutes. And last but not least, he was here with us at the Faculty of Economics and Public Administration to deliver his wonderful course on political economy in the light of history, for which I want to thank him a lot. Professor Hicks, please approach me and receive the PCPE 2006 Visa Memorial Prize for Excellent Economic Education and a diploma of a visiting professor at the Faculty of Economics.
Thank you very much, Professor Shima. I'm very much indebted to Professor Shima for inviting me to come to Prague, not only to participate in this conference, but also to serve as a member of the faculty for a brief time. I have been visiting professor in the Faculty of Economics and Public Administration for the past 2 weeks, and that has given me the honor of attempting to teach a number of the students at the University of Economics, and I'm very happy for that opportunity. In addition, I've received great generosity and hospitality from the Liberal Institute here in Prague, and I've had the opportunity to go to that institute and to make two presentations regarding books of my own, but with respect to subjects in which there's great interest everywhere, including here in the Czech Republic. I'm especially grateful to Professor Shima and to his colleagues who took a great effort to translate some of my recent writing into the Czech language and to produce the book whose cover he showed on the screen a few minutes ago. I'm quite honored to have this appearance in Czech language, and if you read Czech more comfortably than you read English, then I hope you will take the opportunity to read this little book and perhaps to tell your friends or students about it, and perhaps we can spread the word. Finally, I'm honored to present in particular the Wieser Lecture. As Professor Shima mentioned, Wieser was the teacher of F.A. Hayek at the University of Vienna. Hayek, of course, lived a long time and influenced very many people. In a sense, he taught millions of people, directly or indirectly. But I was one of those privileged to know Hayek in person, to meet him some 30 years ago, and to spend time with him. And I've been greatly influenced during my career by Hayek's work, and I continue to study them today. So Wieser begat Hayek, and Hayek, in a way, begat me as a scholar. I want to speak briefly to you in this lecture about a topic that I have been studying for many years. I first began to think seriously about it more than 30 years ago. In the beginning, I did not write about it, but I did spend a good deal of time arguing about it with my colleague, Douglas North, who was at that time one of the experts on the relationship of government to the American economy in U.S. economic history. I did not always agree with my colleague, and after a number of years, I finally decided that perhaps my views ought to be written down and expressed more fully. And so I set out to write a book, which was not published until 1987, called Crisis and Leviathan. So in one way or another, I have been working on the subject of the growth of government for 30 years and writing about it for 25 years. And I'm well aware that some of you in the audience have heard me speak on this topic before. So I apologize in advance if I sing a song that you've heard me sing in the past. If you haven't heard this song, then that's good. It'll be new music to your ears. My work has dealt in many ways, not simply with the growth of government as a general phenomenon, especially in the United States and in the Western countries, but in particular with the role that crises, national emergencies, have played in the growth of government. When I began to read the literature about the growth of government, which was beginning to be of considerable interest in the field of economics and political science in the late 1970s and early 1980s, I found that very few economists had anything much to say about any special role that crisis might have played in that process of growth. There were some who spoke about it, but usually only in passing. There was a book by the British writers Peacock and Wiseman that dealt with it at some length, but only with regard to the history of the growth of the British state's fiscal activities. They were at pains to argue that there had existed a definite effect from the two world wars that placed the growth of the state in Great Britain on a higher trajectory than it would have had if the wars had never taken place. So Peacock and Wiseman were already talking about a theme that I would follow in many ways for the next several decades. Today I want to trace out the logic, as I understand it, of how crises play an especially prominent role in the process of the growth of government. These ideas were developed in the first place to help me understand better the course of economic history in the United States. Eventually, I came to see that they might also have substantial application in understanding the growth of government in other countries, certainly in the UK, but perhaps in other places as well. And I continue to believe that if they do not apply exactly in every historical case, they apply to many other countries, at least in part. I begin by assuming that the political rulers of society have considerable autonomy, which is to say, the rulers do not simply represent in some way the resultant of various forces brought to bear upon them by civil society. They have, in a sense, room for maneuver in order to seek ends that no one in civil society may have, to seek ends absolutely their own. I do not claim that rulers in any society are without constraints. Even in a dictatorship, the ruler is constrained in some way by forces that lie outside his control. In civil society, there may be active resistance, there may be latent resistance, there may be only potential resistance that might mount, but every ruler must bear in mind actual or potential resistance to the actions he chooses to take. So rulers, I assume, would like to expand their power, perhaps for noble reasons, as they see them, perhaps for vicious reasons, as even they might admit, were they compelled. But whatever the reasons, rulers can achieve their ends better if they have more power to determine what happens in the society they rule. So there is a constant pressure. Rulers seek to expand their powers, and in reaction to that, or working in opposition to it, various forces in civil society resist that expansion of governmental power and press against it. At any given moment, the boundary between those decisions about resource allocation and enjoyment made by the ruler and his apparatus of government and those decisions made by members of civil society, by what nowadays is usually called the private sector, the boundary between those two opposing forces will represent a placement of the size of government. Many measures of the size of government have been used in research. When I began my studies, it was common for the size of government to be measured by such variables as government spending relative to gross domestic product. Similar measures have been used. We might alternatively use a measure such as employment by the state as a proportion of all employment. These kinds of measures were appealing to mainstream economists and political scientists because they can be readily quantified, and therefore they lent themselves to use in econometric models. I believe in many ways it was unfortunate that the study of the growth of government began on this basis, because one consequence was that immediately many very real and important elements of government power were neglected, unmeasured. Sometimes analysts would recognize their existence but proceed simply by claiming that those parts of government size that were not measured by conventional measures were correlated closely with the parts that were measured. Unfortunately, they made no attempt to demonstrate the validity of that assumption, and only a little study is required to show that in many cases it is not correct. Very often, we may see no trace of the growth of government in a conventional measure, such as government spending relative to the gross domestic product, and yet government's power and its control over decision-making in society may grow enormously by virtue of legal changes, changes in regulations, changes in judicial rulings, or other means. Therefore, when I wrote my book, I decided to look not only at conventional measures of the growth of government, but to look at other evidence with regard to how government might have strengthened its powers over time. I believe that everyone should pay attention to these broader measures. If not, we risk making serious mistakes in our interpretations. Within my framework of understanding, then, the question for the rulers, the question for the government in power, is always the question how to move the boundary, how to move the dividing line between those decisions about resource allocation and enjoyment made by the government and those made by others. Move it in favor of the government's decision making. If we ask what conditions are required for the government to succeed in that effort, I believe we'll find that two conditions are fundamental. The first is that within society, a dominant ideology exists which leads people to look upon the government for their salvation. An ideology which causes people to demand, as it were, that in the face of some perceived problem, especially a serious problem affecting many people in society, government should do something. It should not stand by and simply declare that people should take care of the problem themselves. An ideology must exist that government do something. Now, one might think that's only natural for people to expect or demand, but in reality, it has been the case in some previous times and places that people did not, in general, have that ideology with regard to the role of government in society. If you were able to transport yourself by time machine to the United States in, let us say, the year 1850, you would find that the dominant ideology at that time was one that led people to think of government as properly confined to a very narrow role. And even very serious societal problems did not cause them to think that government should do anything. They looked to their own salvation. They expected that in adversity, people would seek and receive help from their friends, their relatives, their neighbors, from voluntary associations, from charities that existed or might be formed, from the churches, from large numbers of institutions actively operating in civil society. If you had suggested to them that government ought to get involved, they would have resisted the suggestion. They would have said, that would be a mistake. Why? They would have said, because government cannot be trusted to expand beyond its narrow, minimal functions of maintaining order and protecting private property. If it is expanded any further, then we risk even further expansion. And eventually we bear the risk that government will become tyrannical. The American people had mounted a revolution against what they believed to be the tyranny of the British state. And they, as the 19th century had worn on, they had developed even stronger views with regard to the importance of a free economy and the maintenance of limited government. The British, at about the same time, had a dominant ideology not very different. Laissez-faire was the name, first proposed by the French physiocrats of the late 18th century, but adopted with wide currency in the 19th century and used with either pride or with mockery to refer to the view that government should be kept limited, small, that people should have self-responsibility and not look to the state for their salvation. Of course, that ideological condition changed everywhere. Everywhere that it had existed in the 19th century, it began to grow weaker toward the end of the 19th century. And by the early 20th century in the United States, the balance was beginning to tip in favor of a view that sounds much more modern, a view that government ought to be active, that government has the potential to solve many social problems, and that it is entirely right and proper that people look to the government to solve problems, small as well as big. So with the development of socialism and other collectivist views, throughout the Western world, people began to think about government in a different way. The second condition that makes the expansion of government power successful, especially in a crisis, is the sudden occurrence of a threat. Anything that makes people suddenly afraid, fearful of their well-being, either their lives, perhaps their economic well-being, perhaps some other aspect of their security. Crisis. An appropriate ideological precondition plus a crisis gives rise almost automatically to the growth of government, because those conditions lead to an increased deference to government action, giving the government more autonomy and more discretion, decreased government resistance in civil society. Forces that might have resisted the growth of government in normal times may decide that in crisis, government expansion is desirable. When events happen in this way, when a crisis occurs, government expands, there are definite consequences. These events are never transitory. They're never events that come and go and then afterward leave everything in society just as it was before the crisis. They always leave residues behind for several reasons. First is that during the crisis, when government expands, it often creates new institutions to deal with the perceived crisis. Perhaps new agencies, new bureaus, new laws, new judicial rulings. And with the passing of the crisis, these institutions proved to have permanent staying power, the ability to remain alive during normal times, even though they were created expressly for the purpose of dealing with an emergency. They always have supporters, often those who've operated them during the crisis. And those supporters have a built-in advantage because they know more about these institutions than anyone else. So they can always defend them very, very astutely, whereas the opponents may not be so well placed to argue against them. Often, the supporters of crisis-created institutions will see a potential for turning those institutions to new uses. They may admit that the emergency has passed and yet argue that these same institutions, though created to deal with the crisis, can be used very usefully in normal times. Everyone understands that a bureau is easier to create than to destroy. In my country, it's fair to say that a government agency is almost impossible to destroy under modern conditions. A few have been abolished, but very few. The second thing that happens after the crisis has passed is that we find there have been ideological changes. Ideologies do not simply spring from people's study of great books. Especially for ordinary people, ideological change springs in considerable part from people's way of understanding and reacting to their own experience. No experience makes a greater impact on them than the experience of national emergency, of great wars, for example, of great business depressions. These things affect almost everyone in a substantial way. They cannot be ignored. So they come to have an effect on everyone's thinking. And often, the kind of change that crisis leaves in its wake is the view that government really ought to play a bigger role than it played before the crisis. People will be told, of course, by the government managers of crisis institutions that they have done a splendid job in dealing with crisis, that the institutions they created have operated with great success, even though historians may later tell us their efforts were complete failures. They have a personal interest in justifying or even glorifying what they've done. And often they have a personal interest in perpetuating it as well. Of course, the government will use propaganda before, during, and after any crisis to justify an expanded role for itself. Here in Prague, I don't need to give you any lessons about propaganda. We all understand that very often propaganda misses its target, that after a while people may dismiss it, disregard it, and think of it as nothing more than noise. And yet, there must be a purpose served by propaganda, because every modern government makes great efforts to propagandize its own citizens. I'm confident that it has some effect. As a result of these consequences of crisis, each crisis episode under modern ideological conditions tends to take a characteristic form, and I call the taking of this form a ratchet effect. The diagram shows a stylized representation of how a crisis episode operates. I have pretended in measuring my variable that I am God, and that therefore I can measure a perfect index of the size of government. I can measure all the ways in which government exerts power or control over decision making in society, and that's measured on the vertical axis. Time is measured on the horizontal axis. What I've shown is that before the crisis, government is already growing, as it was tending to grow from the late 19th century onward in most of the Western countries. Not rapidly, slowly, but growing little by little. With the onset of crisis, we have a sudden increase in the size of government. Government begins to do things it had not done before. It begins to exercise new functions, to impose new controls. So government becomes suddenly quite a lot bigger. And perhaps for a time, between the points I've labeled C and D, it operates at a high, expanded level. Every crisis ends, and when it ends, the justifications disappear for the crisis measures that government has taken. And normally, government does, in fact, retrench after the crisis. It does abandon some of the crisis measures. It does close some of the emergency bureaus. It may allow some of its emergency laws to lapse, or it may actually repeal some of them. After all, there are always insistent demands from civil society that we get back to normal life. When people can no longer see a clear reason for greatly expanded government power, there will be some demand for its retrenchment. And so there will be some reduction in its power. But as the diagram shows, that reduction will not bring society back to the status quo antebellum. It will not bring us back to the point where the process began before the crisis. Indeed, as I've shown it, it will not even bring us back to the trend line of government growth that existed before the crisis. So it raises the level of the size of government, by which here I mean size, scope, power, all rolled into a single measure. It raises it to a higher level, even if it grows at the same rate as it grew before, and makes it not bigger for only a while, but bigger permanently. Now, this is a representation of just one episode, but what we can easily imagine is that as we continue in time, another crisis does come. When I wrote my first book in 1987 on this topic, it was not well received by many reviewers. At the time, many people argued that big government was a problem of the past, that the Reagan Revolution, as some people called it, had tamed Leviathan, that we did not need to worry any longer about the growth of government, that we might even look forward to a shrinking of the size of government before long. My response was then, and remained from that time on, nonsense. It will take only the next big emergency to change all of these constraints you believe are now operating in 1987. And such a crisis will certainly occur. I did not make a prophecy of what kind of crisis that would be, although I mentioned certain possibilities, including economic collapse, war, and rampant terrorism. Not much time had to pass before, in the year 2001, in the United States, another perceived crisis did strike with suddenness, and the effect was identical in its basic structure. Sudden, heightened fear, insecurity, a turning to the government, even by people who had expressed the greatest distrust of the government, the greatest desire to shrink it. Many then turned to the government, looking to it to protect them from what they believe might be a terrible menace awaiting them should the terrorists continue to carry out attacks such as that of September 11, 2001. The government was entirely happy to respond to those demands. It took many actions immediately. It passed new laws, including a law known as the USA Patriot Act, providing for much greater government surveillance, not just of potential terrorists, but of all people. It provided for the confiscation of private assets, not simply of people who might be engaged in supporting terrorism, but of anyone suspected of any federal crime. In a variety of ways, these laws enacted ostensibly to protect against terrorism were immediately turned to a variety of other purposes. Anyone with historical perspective might have expected precisely that course of events. And indeed, when I spoke to journalists within 2 weeks after those attacks of 9/11, I predicted that these consequences would follow. I'm sorry to say my predictions were correct, and they've only become more correct in the years since then. This is a graph showing the federal government spending relative to gross national product in the United States from the year 1790 all the way to 1990. So we have a very long view here. What we can see is that in the 19th century, the federal government never spent very much money as a proportion of gross domestic product. There are two places that stand out in the 19th century. Both have to do with wars. The first little bulge above the trend line occurred during America's second war with England. And the big spike in the middle of the century, of course, occurred during the war between the states in the 1860s. But other than that, the federal government was held well in check for more than a century. And even after the Civil War, though there were some consequences of the kind I've described, in general, the federal government returned to the same kinds of activities that it had traditionally undertaken, which were quite limited. So that even in the early 20th century, the federal government was a relatively small factor in American life. The state governments and local governments played larger roles, but even when all governments together are combined, their expenditures relative to gross national product were only about 7 or 8% on the eve of World War I. However, as I've said, during the early 20th century, a change in ideology had taken place, especially among opinion leaders in the United States. We call it progressivism. And that change, something like what Europeans call social democracy, that change had had a powerful effect in altering the conditions in which any future crisis would operate. This is a depiction of Swedish central government spending as a percentage of gross national product. Now, if you have held in your memory the preceding display, you'll immediately see some substantial similarities between what happened in the United States historically and what happened in Sweden. And that's really remarkable, I believe, because these two societies differ in so many ways. Especially, they differ in that Sweden was not a belligerent in either of the world wars. And yet, you see from this chart, the same kinds of crisis effects and perhaps ratchets that are apparent in the American experience of the 20th century. Perhaps you know that even though Sweden was not a belligerent in World War I or World War II, it prepared to be a belligerent. And it was that preparation that explains the spikes in central government spending we see in this chart. Just as in the United States, during the Cold War, actual fighting explains relatively little of the amounts the government spent for defense. Preparation for war accounts for the great bulk of that spending. So what we see in historical experience, these two graphs being examples, we could look at many different measures. None of them is ideal, such as my God's eye view in the schema. But all of these measures tend to show evidence of the operation of a crisis ratchet effect. If what I've said is approximately correct, then there are some implications. Two in particular I'll mention. The first implication is that government leaders will make efforts to exploit exogenous crises, by which I mean crises that come upon a society from the outside, crises that were not deliberately brought about by anyone as such. Crises such as the wars, the world wars that came to have such a great effect on the United States, coming from the outside. Government leaders will exploit exogenous crises to serve their own interests. They will readily grasp new power, which they will say are necessary to give people protection from heightened threats. And, in addition, government leaders will be strongly tempted, especially when no exogenous crisis arises, to create a crisis or the appearance of one. There has been in history more than one burning of the Reichstag. That's become a kind of metaphor for the crisis that was false. The crisis perhaps engineered by the very leaders who used it to justify their seizure of new power. You need not be a conspiracy theorist. Historians have documented very well many of the instances in which government either creates a crisis or propagates the fear that a crisis exists in order to justify some new power. I actually maintain that this process has become almost chronic in modern life. In my country, any given day brings upon the television screen the presentation of what I call the danger du jour, the new threat, the one people hadn't been aware of before. Something poison in the water, something toxic in the food, some grave environmental risk, some terrorist group we had known nothing about before. Each day, a new threat, a new danger, and always the implied or explicit implication that government must do something to protect us from this new danger du jour. Modern people are bombarded with messages designed to make them afraid. And not surprisingly, many are indeed afraid. As long ago as the 1940s, Bertrand de Jouvenel wrote that the characteristic feature of modern minds is apprehension, is fear, which seems anomalous in so many ways, because modern people are in fact so much more secure than their ancestors ever dreamed of being. We don't worry about starvation. We don't worry about the disastrous effects of a bad crop year. We don't worry about the many things that our ancestors had legitimate reason to fear. And yet, we've all become irrationally fearful. The second implication is that government will grow relentlessly. It will exploit exogenous crises, or it will create endogenous crises, and it will use them to expand its powers and extend its sway over civil society. And it will continue to do so until it manifestly wrecks the economy or the society. We've seen experiences of that. We know that the Soviet Union was a society where the rulers expanded their power until they manifestly wrecked the economy, and it could no longer be denied. Not even they could deny it. We've seen in more civilized places, such as Sweden, the welfare state expanded to such great limits that eventually even the rulers became aware that they were wrecking the Swedish economy. Their high taxes, their extreme welfare state benefits were making it impossible for economic growth to continue. And so even they, the Swedes, began to back away from those limits they had reached. But until such limits are reached, all modern governments will continue to grow. Some 200 years ago, Thomas Jefferson said that the natural tendency is for government to gain ground and liberty to yield. If that was true in Jefferson's day, how much truer it is today. So let me conclude briefly by asking, is a reversal possible? Of course. In matters of human society, we face very few impossibilities. We're the makers of our own history. But in order for a reversal of this process to occur, two things must be done. Someone must deconstruct collectivist ideology, by which I mean both deconstruct it in the sense of making people aware of its implications, taking it apart as literary analysts take apart a text. But they must also deconstruct it in the sense that they must tear it down. They must replace it by an ideology more fit for a free society. Secondly, someone must deconstruct this atmosphere of fear and insecurity that now envelops Western people. Someone must somehow show them that these fears and insecurities are in large part unfounded, that they have less to fear than they think from the sources they've been brought to fear, whereas they have more to fear from the governments they believe will save them. Modern people in the West, having given up their traditional worship of the Christian God, have transferred their worship effectively to the state. Like Winston Smith in George Orwell's novel 1984, they have come to love Big Brother. The state is effectively their God. But the state, at bottom, is a false god, a gigantic hoax, a trick played by the palace priests of the rulers. People regard it all too often as a God of love, like the Christian God in the Bible's New Testament, for which they substituted it. But in biblical terms, it is actually a God of wrath, more akin to the Christian God of the Bible's Old Testament. It imposes harsh demands on them for sacrifices of all kinds, and it stands ready to wreak violent punishment on the people who resist its demands. To escape from the sway of this false religion of the state, people must come to understand that despite its constant pressures, its constant promises to save people from all dangers and to solve all their problems, big and small, the government will not, indeed, it cannot, save them. To gain genuine solutions to their problems, people must learn to take responsibility for themselves, making voluntary arrangements and transactions, and creating voluntary organizations for the attainment of their purposes. A society of free and responsible individuals is the only one that holds out any real hope for a better world in the long run. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Hicks, for your wonderful lecture. Before I release all of you for a small refreshment we have make ready for you, let me make a few technical comments. As you know, there are lunches and dinners prepared for the participants of PCPE. There are still some available dinners today and lunches and dinners tomorrow, so please stop at the registration desk and join us for those meals. This evening we have a very nice restaurant below the Prague Castle, sort of traditional Czech one, for very reasonable prices actually. So as we ordered a beautiful weather for you too, I am sure we will go after dinner up the hill, see the Prague Castle and see Prague at night. So please register for those meals. And for those students who participated in the Best Scholarly Student Paper contest, please meet Professor Schauer 10 minutes to 4 here by the stairs to register for the ceremony that will follow. Now, I would like all of you to invite for a small refreshment. We produce some chlebičky, the little Czech sandwiches for you, and juices and pastry. So please enjoy the break. And we'll meet here at 4 o'clock sharp. Thank you.